great fire banked high and red flamed in the grate, and under the ivy-twined branches of the chandelier, the Christmas table was spread. They had come home a little late, and still dinner was not ready. But it would be ready in a jiffy, his mother had said. They were waiting for the door to open and for the servants to come in, holding the big dishes covered with their heavy metal covers. All were waiting. Uncle Charles, who sat far away in the shadow of the window, Dante and Mr. Casey, who sat in the easy chairs at either side of the hearth, Stephen, seated on a chair between them, his feet resting on the toasted boss. Mr. Dedalus looked at himself in the pier glass above the mantelpiece, waxed out his moustache ends, and then, parting his coat tails, stood with his back to the glowing fire. And still, from time to time, he withdrew a hand from his coat tail to wax out one of his moustache ends. Mr. Casey leaned his head to one side and, smiling, tapped the gland of his neck with his fingers. And Stephen smiled, too, for he knew now that it was not true that Mr. Casey had a purse of silver in his throat. He smiled to think how the silvery noise which Mr. Casey used to make had deceived him. And when he had tried to open Mr. Casey's hand to see if the purse of silver was hidden there, he had seen that the fingers could not be straightened out, and Mr. Casey had told him that he had got those three cramped fingers making a birthday present for Queen Victoria. Mr. Casey tapped the gland of his neck and smiled at Stephen with his sleepy eyes. And Mr. Dedalus said to him,
"Yes, well, no, that's all right. Oh, we had a good walk, hadn't we, John? Yes. Well, I wonder if there's any likelihood of dinner this evening. Yes, ah, well, no, we had a good breath of ozone round the head today. Ha-ha, bedad.
You didn't stir out at all, Mrs. Reardon." Dante frowned and said shortly, "No." Mr. Dedalus dropped his coat tails and went over to the sideboard. He brought forth a great stone jar of whiskey from the locker and filled the decanter slowly, bending now and then to see how much he'd poured in. Then, replacing the jar in the locker, he poured a little of the whiskey into two glasses, added a little water, and came back with them to the fireplace.
"A thimbleful, John, just to whet your appetite."
Mr. Casey took the glass, drank, and placed it near him on the mantelpiece. Then he said,
"Well, I can't help thinking of our friend Christopher manufacturing that champagne for those fellas."
Dedalus laughed loudly.
"Is it Christy? Because there's more cunning in one of those warts in his bald head than in a pack of jack foxes. And he has such a soft mouth when he's speaking to you, don't you know? He's very moist and watery about the dewlaps, God bless him."
Stephen, seeing and hearing the hotel keeper through his father's face and voice, laughed. Mr. Dedalus put up his eyeglass and, staring down at him, said,
"And what are you laughing at, you little puppy, you?"
The servants entered and placed the dishes on the table. Mrs. Dedalus followed and the places were arranged. "Sit over," she said. Mr. Dedalus went to the end of the table.
"Now, Mrs. Reardon, sit over. John, sit you down, me hearty."
"Now, Stephen." Stephen stood up in his place to say the grace before meals. "Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts, which through thy bounty we are about to receive through Christ our Lord. Amen." All blessed themselves. And Mr. Dedalus, with a sigh of pleasure, lifted from the dish the heavy cover pearled around the edge with glistening drops. Stephen looked at the plump turkey which had lain trussed and skewered on the kitchen table. He knew that his father had paid a guinea for it in Dunn's of Delier Street, and that the man had prodded it often at the breastbone to show how good it was. It was his first Christmas dinner, and he thought of his little brothers and sisters who were waiting in the nursery, as he had often waited till the pudding came. The deep, low collar and the Eton jacket made him feel queer and oldish. And that morning, when his mother had brought him down to the parlor dressed for mass, his father had cried. That was because he was thinking of his own father, and Uncle Charles had said so too. Mr. Dedalus covered the dish and began to eat hungrily. Then he said,
"Poor old Christy, he's nearly lopsided now with roguery."
"Simon, you haven't given Mrs. Reardon any sauce."
"Haven't I? Oh, Mrs. Reardon, pity the poor blind."
Dante covered her plate with her hands and said, "No, thanks." Mr. Dedalus turned to Uncle Charles.
"And how are you off, sir?"
Right as the mail, Simon. You, John?
I am all right. Go on yourself. Mary? Here, Stephen, here's something to make your hair curl.
He poured sauce freely over Stephen's plate and set the boat again on the table.
That was a good answer our friend made to the cannon, Hart, said Mr. Dedalus.
Well, I didn't think he had that much in him, said Mr. Casey.
I'll pay your dues, Father, when you cease turning the House of God into a polling booth.
A nice answer, said Dante, for any man calling himself a Catholic to give to his priest.
Yeah, well, so they've only themselves to blame, said Mr. Dedalus. If they took a fool's advice, they'd confine their attention to religion.
It is religion. They're doing their duty in warning the people.
We go to the House of God, Mr. Casey said, in all humility, to pray to our Maker, or not to hear election addresses.
It is religion. They're right. They must direct their flocks.
And preach politics from the altar, is it? Asked Mr. Dedalus.
Certainly. It's a question of public morality. A priest would not be a priest if he didn't tell his flock what's right and what is wrong. Mr. Dedalus laid down her knife and fork.
Oh, for pity's sake, and pity's sake, let's have no political discussion on this day of all days in the year.
Quite right, ma'am, said Uncle Charles. Now, Simon, that's quite enough now. Not another word now.
Yes, said Mr. Dedalus. Well, now then, who's for more turkey?
Nobody answered. Dante said, nice language for any Catholic to use.
Mrs. Reardon, I appeal to you, said Mrs. Dedalus, to let the matter drop now.
And am I to sit here and listen to the pastors of my church being flouted?
Nobody's saying a word against them, said Mr. Dedalus, as long as they don't meddle in politics.
The bishops and priests of Ireland have spoken, said Dante, and they must be obeyed.
Well, let them leave politics alone, said Mr. Casey. Or the people may leave their church alone.
You hear? Said Dante, turning to Mrs. Dedalus.
Mr. Casey, Simon, said Mrs. Dedalus, let it end now.
Too bad, too bad, said Uncle Charles.
What, cried Mr. Dedalus, were we to desert him at the bidding of the English people?
He was no longer worthy to lead, said Dante. He was a public sinner.
Ah, we're all sinners and black sinners, said Mr. Casey.
Woe be to the man by whom the scandal cometh, said Mrs. Reardon. It'd be better for him that a millstone were tied about his neck and that he were cast into the depth of the sea, rather than that he should scandalize one of these, my least little ones. That is the language of the Holy Ghost.
And very bad language, if you ask me, said Mr. Dedalus.
Oh, Simon, Simon, said Uncle Charles, the boy.
Oh, yes. I was thinking about the bad language of that railway porter. Well, no, that's all right. Here, Stephen, show me your plate, old chap. He's away now, here.
He heaped up the food on Stephen's plate and served Uncle Charles and Mr. Casey to large pieces of turkey and splashes of sauce. Mrs. Dedalus was eating little, and Dante sat with her hands in her lap. She was red in the face. Mr. Dedalus rooted with the carvers at the end of the dish and said,
there's a tasty bit here we call the Pope's nose. Now, if any lady or gentleman...
He held a piece of fowl up on the prong of the carving fork. Nobody spoke. He put it on his own plate.
Well, you can't say, but you were asked. I think I'd better eat it myself because I'm
not well in me health lately. He winked at Stephen and, replacing the dish cover, began to eat again. There was a silence while he ate. Then he said,
the day kept up fine after all. Plenty of strangers down too.
Nobody spoke.
I think there were more strangers down than last Christmas. Well,
my Christmas has been spoiled anyhow.
There could be neither luck nor grace, Dante said, in a house where there's no respect for the pastors of the church.
Mr. Dedalus threw his knife and fork noisily on his plate.
Respect, he said. Is it for Billy with the lip or for the tub of guts of banana?
Respect, princes of the church, said Mr. Casey.
Lord Leitrim's coachman, yes, said Mr. Dedalus.
They're the Lord's anointed, Dante said. They're an honour to their country.
Tub of guts. Oh, he has a handsome face, mind you, in repose. You should see that fella lapping up his bacon and cabbage of a cold winter's day. Oh, Johnny.
Really, Simon, you shouldn't speak that way before Stephen. It's not right.
Oh, he'll remember all this when he grows up, said Dante hotly. The language he heard against God and religion and priests in his own home.
And let him remember, too, cried Mr. Casey, the language with which the priests and the priest's pawns broke Parnell's heart and hounded him into his grave. Let him remember that, too, when he grows up.
Sons of bitches, cried Mr. Dedalus. When he was down, they turned on him to betray him and rend him like rats in a sewer. Low-lived dogs. And they look it. By Christ, they look it. They behaved rightly. They obeyed their bishops and their priests. Honor to them.
Well, it's perfectly dreadful to say that not even for one day in the year, said Mrs. Dedalus, can we be free from these dreadful disputes. Uncle Charles raised his hands mildly.
Come now, come now, come now. Can we not have our opinions, whatever they are, without this bad temper and this bad language? It's too bad, surely.
Mrs. Dedalus spoke to Dante in a low voice, but Dante said loudly, I will not say nothing. I will defend my church and my religion when it's insulted and spit upon by renegade Catholics.
Mr. Casey pushed his plate rudely into the middle of the table.
Tell me, did I tell you that story about a very famous spit?
You did not, John, said Mr. Dedalus.
Why then, it's a most instructive story. It happened not long ago in the County Wicklow, where we are now. And I may tell you, ma'am, that I, if you mean me, am no renegade Catholic. I am a Catholic as my father was, and his father before him, and his father before him again, when we gave up our lives rather than sell our faith.
The more shame to you now, Dante said, to speak as you do.
The story, John, said Mr. Dedalus, smiling. Let's have the story, anyhow.
Catholic, indeed. The blackest Protestant in the land wouldn't speak the language I've heard this evening.
Mr. Dedalus began to sway his head to and fro, crooning like a country singer.
I'm no Protestant, I tell you again, said Mr. Casey, flushing.
Mr. Dedalus, still crooning and swaying his head, began to sing,
Oh, come on, ye Roman Catholics that never went to Mass.
He took up his knife and fork again in good humour and set to eating, saying to Mr. Casey,
Well, let's have the story, John. Huh? It'll help us to digest.
Stephen looked with affection at Mr. Casey's face, which stared across the table over his joined hands. He liked to sit near him at the fire, looking up at his dark, fierce face. But his dark eyes were never fierce, and his slow voice was good to listen to. But why was he then against the priests? Because Dante must be right then. But he had heard his father say that she was a spoiled nun, and that she'd come out of the convent in the Alleghenies when her brother had got the money from the savages for the trinkets and the chainies. Perhaps that made her severe against Parnell. And she didn't like him to play with Eileen, because Eileen was a Protestant. And when she was young, she knew children that used to play with Protestants, and the Protestants used to make fun of the litany of the Blessed Virgin.
Tower of ivory, they used to say, house of gold. How could a woman be a tower of ivory or a house of gold?
Who was right then? And he remembered the evening in the infirmary in Clongowes, the dark waters, the light of the pier head, and the moan of sorrow from the people when they had heard. Eileen had long white hands. One evening when playing tig, she'd put her hands over his eyes, long and white and thin and cold and soft. That was ivory, a cold white thing. That was the meaning of the Tower of Ivory.
The story's very short and sweet, Mr. Casey said. It was one day down in Arcla, a cold, bitter day, not long before the chief died, may God have mercy on him. He closed his eyes wearily and paused.
Mr. Dedalus took a bone from his plate and tore some meat from it with his teeth, saying,
Before he was killed, you mean?
Mr. Casey opened his eyes, sighed, and went on.
He was down in Arcla one day. We were down there at a meeting, and after the meeting was over, we had to make our way to the railway station through the crowd. Oh, God, such booing and baaing, man, you never heard. They called us all the names in the world. Well, there was one old lady, and a drunken old harridan she was, surely. and paid all her attention to me. And she kept dancing along beside me in the mud, bawling and screaming into my face, "Priest Hunter, the Paris Funds, Mr. Fox, Kitty O'Shea." "And what did you do, John?" asked Mr. Dedalus. "I let her bawl away. It was a cold day, and to keep up my heart, I had, saving your presence, ma'am, a quid of Tullamore in my mouth. And sure, I couldn't say a word in any case because my mouth was full of tobacco juice."
"Well, John?"
"Well, I let her bawl away to her heart's content, Kitty O'Shea and the rest of it, till at last she called that lady a name that I won't sully this Christmas board. Now, your ears, ma'am, now my own lips be repeating." He paused. Mr. Dedalus, lifting his head from the bone, asked, "And what did you do, John?"
"Do," said Mr. Casey. "She stuck her ugly old face up at me when she said it, and I had me mouth full of tobacco juice. I bent down to her, and says I to her like that, says I to her like that, right into her eye. 'Ow, Jesus, Mary and Joseph,' says she, 'I'm blinded and drowned.'"
Mr. Dedalus laughed loudly too and lay back in his chair while Uncle Charles swayed his head to and fro. Dante looked terrible angry.
"Very nice. Very nice."
Mr. Dedalus gave a snort of contempt. "Ah, John," he said, "it's true for them. We're an unfortunate, priest-ridden race, and always were and always will be till the end of the chapter."
Uncle Charles shook his head. "Ah, a bad business, a bad business.
A priest-ridden, God-forsaken race."
He pointed to the portrait of his grandfather on the wall to his right.
"Do you see that old chap up there, John? He was a good Irishman when there was no money in the job. He was condemned to death as a white boy. But he had a saying about our clerical friends that he'd never let one of them put his 2 feet under his mahogany."
Dante broke in angrily.
"If we are a priest-ridden race, we ought to be proud of it. They're the apple of God's eye. Touch them not, says Christ, for they are the apple of my eye." "And can we not love our country then?" asked Mr. Casey. "Are we not to follow the man that was born to lead us? A traitor to his country, a traitor, an adulterer. The priests were right to abandon him. The priests were always the true friends of Ireland." "Were they, faith," said Mr. Casey. "Didn't the bishops of Ireland betray us in the time of the Union, when Bishop Lanigan presented an address of loyalty to the Marquess Cornwallis? Didn't the bishops and priests sell the aspirations of their country in 1829? In return for Catholic emancipation, didn't they denounce the Fenian movement from the pulpit and in the confession box? And didn't they dishonour the ashes of Terence Bellew McManus?"
His face was glowing with anger, and Stephen felt the glow rise to his own cheek as the spoken words thrilled him. Mr. Dedalus uttered a guffaw of coarse scorn.
"Be God," he cried, "I forgot little old Paul Cullen, another apple of God's eye."
"Right, right, they were always right. God and morality and religion come first."
Mrs. Dedalus, seeing her excitement, said to her, "Mrs. Reardon, don't excite yourself answering them. God and religion before everything. God and religion before the world." Mr. Casey raised his clenched fist and brought it down on the table with a crash.
"Very well, then. If it comes to that, no God for Ireland."
"John, John," cried Mr. Dedalus, seizing his guest by the coat sleeve. Dante darted across the table, her cheeks shaking. Mr. Casey struggled up from his chair and bent across the table towards her, scraping the air from before his eyes with one hand as though he were tearing aside a cobweb.
"No God for Ireland," he cried. "We've had too much God in Ireland. Away with God." "Blasphemer," screamed Dante. "Devil."
Uncle Charles and Mr. Dedalus pulled Mr. Casey back into his chair again, talking to him from both sides reasonably. He stared before him out of his dark, flaming eyes, repeating,
"Away with God, I say."
Dante shoved her chair violently aside and left the table, upsetting her napkin ring, which rolled slowly along the carpet. At the door, she turned round and shouted down the room, her cheeks flushed and quivering with rage.
"Devil out of hell! We won! We crushed him to death! Fiend!"
The door slammed behind her. Mr. Casey, freeing his arms from his holders, suddenly bowed his head on his hands with a sob of pain.
"Poor Parnell, my dead king."
He sobbed loudly and bitterly. Stephen, raising his terror-stricken face, saw that his father's eyes were full of tears.